We're going to call to order the meeting for the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. Today is March 21st, 2013. We're going to start out with a work session on Senate Bill 465, and we're going to invite Senator Johnson up because the Dash 6 amendments are a little different, and we're going to let her give a little explanation. And, yes, you can bring both of you up. So we're going to open work session on Senate Bill 465. And thank you for the work you guys have been doing, and you can give a short explanation about what our bill was to begin with and what we did.
Okay.
Thank you, Raquel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the original Senate Bill 465 authorized the local government with land use jurisdiction over residential improvements that sustained substantial flood-related damage to cause recordation of substantial damage in the office of the county clerk, and it defines substantial damage. That is something that is different in the Dash 6 amendment. It also authorized a buyer of substantially damaged property to bring cause of action against a seller for treble damages within specified period if local government did not cause notice to be recorded and the seller of the property did not disclose substantial damage in the property disclosure statement. That part has also been changed in the bill. And then it applied to substantial damage occurring on or after the effective date of the act, and this would apply to damage on the Dash 6, would apply to damage before, on, or after. I can read a summary of the Dash 6 amendment unless the senator would like
to. We'll let you, these two.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I can just give the prefatory remarks before I turn it over to the negotiator here. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, and we came to you early on with what we thought was the Kumbaya bill. DLCD was in the room. The flood recovery team from Vernonia was here. We delivered to you what we thought was a perfect piece of public policy. Well, it turns out that it needed a little adjustment. Enter Mr. Jillians and his clients. They have worked very closely with affected parties and the sponsors of the bill, and I believe that Mr. Jillians is about to testify to the effect that we have reached the Kumbaya spot, and we now have a bill for your thoughtful consideration and hopefully a work session. And again, I'd like to thank your very capable staff for being as willing to reach out and be helpful as she has been.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I think the negotiator is the nicest thing I've been called today, Mr. Chair, so I appreciate that. We are in support of the Dash 6 amendments, and we appreciate Senator Johnson working with us on it. We did have a few concerns in the original bill. I think those have been clarified in here, most importantly, creating a process to be able to clear this recording when the damage has been remediated so that the person can move on and sell the property without any problems being associated there. We also recognize the underlying issue in the bill of people not getting notice. I think the Dash 6 amendments accomplished that quite nicely while leaving some flexibility to local governments for how to accomplish that. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So what actually does it change? Because these are fairly substantial amendments, actually. So I just want to make sure that everybody up here, if they vote on it, knows what these do.
As compared to the original
bill. As compared to the original bill.
In the original bill, there was some language around our seller's property disclosure, which, as most of you are familiar with, we tend to guard quite stringently, making sure that it stays uniform throughout the state. And so what this would do, rather than doing things with the seller's property disclosure or saying you failed to do something, the seller's property disclosure will still apply to all these properties as well. It applies to anything unless you have an exemption, and there are four specific reasons why you wouldn't. Primarily, you're a lawyer or you're a bank. You wouldn't actually have the personal knowledge necessary for it. This goes a little further and says, no, the local government can actually have this recorded. So even if you were exempt from the seller's property disclosure, this would be flagged in a title search, which we think is important so that a buyer, hopefully using one of our members, would certainly be instructed to get a title search when they go through the buying process, and it would be flagged during the title search that this, in fact, was damaged. We think this is a good way to accomplish that without creating some special class or some special cause of action separate for one individual thing that's otherwise in the seller's property disclosure.
Mr. Chair, the only other thing that I would add, I did not see him when I came into the room, but I'm in possession of an email from Matthew Krall at DLCD. They testified the first time around. I'm reading from an email dated March the 21st, 2013. He says the new bill would give local governments another tool for mitigating hazards without creating any new requirements for local government and without adding any new restriction for property owners. As such, we support the bill. We support the Dash 6 amendments, and we appreciate the opportunity to work with the sponsors on these amendments. And this is the best part. The result is a bill that is better than any of us could have written on our own.
Okay. We like those kinds
yes.
of things.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any questions for these two?
Just
yes.
briefly, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Clark.
So if the substantial damage is brought into compliance, then what happens to the record? I think.
Mr. Chair, Senator Close, under the language, basically the local jurisdiction is going to establish the process by which it's recorded originally and the process by which it's either erased from the record or they get a certificate of compliance, basically. And it is left to the local jurisdictions to determine the process for that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? You know, this is a work session, and it's a big change, and so if there's anybody out there that came about this particular bill and wants to say anything, raise your hand or forever hold your silence.
Or go to the House.
Yeah. That's right. Okay, good. That's what I was expecting, so I appreciate that. Thank you, Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
So I would entertain a motion.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 6 amendments dated 3/15/2013.
Senator Bertschinger moves the adoption of the Dash 6 amendments dated 3/15/13. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the adoption? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Senator Bertschinger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 465 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bertschinger moves Senate Bill 465 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
No.
Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Senator Johnson, would you like to carry this on the floor?
Thank you for asking me. I'd be pleased.
Very good. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 465, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 677. And we'll have a short explanation of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 677, we heard this on Tuesday, March 19th. It has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. And this is the bill that creates an exception to the requirement that a seasonal farm worker's wages be paid immediately upon termination of employment and allows the employer until noon on the day after termination to pay the seasonal farm worker under certain conditions.
So we are in a work session. Senator Bertschinger.
Well. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 677. Oh, no, that's... Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 677 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bertschinger moves Senate Bill 677 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the bill moves, and who would like to carry this bill? Anyone in particular?
I think we ought to have Senator Thompson.
I think that's a good idea. Yeah. We will have Senator Thompson if he doesn't wish to do it, which I would find.
I'll do it if he doesn't.
Or Senator Pruzanski, either one.
Either way.
Okay. I'm sure
he
will.
I'm here to serve.
Okay. I appreciate that. So we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 677. And should we go to 719? We could. Maybe just wait and give him some time. Yeah, we'll wait and give him some time. We're going to open, just so people know, Senate Bill 719, which is another work session we're having, the fiscal was, we looked at it and some people looked at it and felt that it was a little high, like four times higher than it should have possibly been. And that made some people nervous, and we're having and I'm happy that the people over in LFO are looking at LRO are looking it over and trying to figure out about lambs. And so we're going to hopefully, before the end of the day, we'll get the revised one and we can look that over and maybe work on it. If not, we'll take some testimony from one person to explain why we think that it was a little high. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 580. Oh, we already did that one. We're going to open it on Senate Bill 173. 580. Which one do we want to go first? We'll do 581. And with 581, we have, well, as Raquel is giving us a short explanation, we'll have Mike MacArthur come up.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, Mike MacArthur, Association of Counties.
Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 581 extends the sunset date from January 2nd, 2014 to January 2nd, 2016 for statutes authorizing the declaration of a county fiscal emergency, establishment of fiscal assistance boards, and development of recovery plan when an eligible county is unable to meet a minimally adequate level of state-required services. There is no revenue impact or there's no revenue impact on this bill, but there is a fiscal statement which should be in front of you.
Okay, and with that, Mike, thank you.
Mr. Chair, maybe so bold as to suggest that this is actually related to 173, if you wanted to open them both,
we
have a general discussion both. But this is a continuation of a provision that was passed by the legislature in 2012. It's one of the tools we have in the toolbox, trying to deal with the implications to the state of a county who is in severe fiscal distress. And we've had a great deal of experience. The association has had a great deal of experience counseling those counties that are really struggling right now because of the lack of secure rural schools funding and timber-related revenue. So we're asking you to continue this particular provision, which provides for a declaration and a mechanism for assisting that county should it find itself in that continued situation.
Any questions for
no.
Commissioner? Thank you very much. That's all the people that signed up. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to Senate Bill 581? Then I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 581, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 581. The indeterminate just means that we don't know how many counties, so it's still one that we can work. So with that, Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 581 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Berger moves Senate Bill 581 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I see none. Yes.
Thank you.
Is there any objection to 581? Seeing none, the bill passes. And who would like to carry this bill?
I'll do it.
Okay. Senator Przanski will carry the bill. We are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 173. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 173. We'll have a short explanation, and while that's happening, Mike MacArthur and Chris Flick. Fick.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 173 creates a service delivery technical assistance program in the governor's office to assist counties in fiscal distress. It requires the program to award grants for service delivery innovation, contract for the provision of technical assistance to public bodies, and convene necessary task forces and work groups.
Whoever wants to start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties. As I mentioned on Senate Bill 581, we're assembling tools in the toolbox to assist and deal with counties who are in fiscal distress. We've been working closely with the Oregon Consensus Program. For instance, during the winter of late 2011, early 2012, Oregon Consensus ran a project in Curry County, bringing together a citizens group to make recommendations about what they could do in their situation. One of the things we find is that county commissioners, as well-trained as they are, as well-educated as they are, don't know all the answers. And bringing in folks with great administrative experience and, in some cases, academic experience can be a big assistance to these folks. I want to mention, like, in Curry, Coos, Josephine, Klamath, and Wheeler, we have, of the three-member commissions, two commissioners who just began in January, and in three of the five of those counties, the other commissioner has only 2 years' experience. None of those counties have a county administrator, although they do have a great number of very capable staff. Having the third-party outside expertise that can come in and advise them is really an invaluable tool. And I'll let Mr. Johnson talk about how that works and some of the discussions we've had about that. But the governor has put $2 million in his budget that would be used to fund this work.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Mr. MacArthur mentioned, my name is Jim Johnson. I work for the National Policy Consensus Center at Portland State University. We operate the Oregon Consensus Program and Oregon Solutions Program. In addition, I'm a retired county administrator of Lane County and Eugene City Manager for about 5 years. What Senate Bill 173 does and the $2 million that's been set aside is establish what we like to call the State of Oregon Local Government Efficiency and Innovation Grant Program. It's based on programs that are run in at least three different states, New York, Ohio, and the state of Michigan. All of them are trying to provide an incentive for local governments to work together, to form intergovernmental partnerships, to collaborate and work together to provide more efficiency and cost savings in the way they operate their local governments. What we're suggesting is providing dollars to fund feasibility studies. Let's say, for example, that two counties want to run a jail together. A small city wants the county to provide local government public safety services. The feasibility dollars would provide that mechanism to hire a neutral third party to come in and work with the local governments in order to finance that feasibility work. So it's based on the work that's been done in a number of different states, and we think it would be a great benefit to provide an incentive for local governments in Oregon to collaborate and work together in a partnership way.
Chair Roblin, other members of the committee, Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. We, too, are supportive of Senate Bill 173. We're understandably very concerned about our partners in county government and the financial difficulties that they face, both from a public safety, elections, assessment, and taxation standpoint. Their well-being is our well-being, so we're supportive of this effort to provide some incentives, some resources to help facilitate the coordination amongst local governments to provide services more efficiently. Thank you.
So any questions for this group?
I have questions.
Okay. Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the line that says excludes fees from...
Wrong bill. Law 581. Law 173.
Oh, I'm sorry. I withdraw my question.
Okay. Senator Close. Senator Close. Thank you. And now we'll go to Senator Barger.
My assumption is this would be at the request of the counties.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Bertrager, yes.
So it wouldn't be forced upon them. They'd have to request.
It's a competitive grant application.
Okay.
Other questions?
How about a comment?
Yes.
Jim, nice seeing you.
And I guess what I want to just put on the record, when we were talking about this in the last session about how we move forward, this is about saying, for an example would be, you could bring a consensus group and start looking and saying, in Curry County, the city of Brookings has a police force that may have the ability, with a little bit of county money, to add some people, and they could actually work and coordinate with the county to provide law enforcement services maybe for a bigger swath, or the Brookings and Gold Beach together could work out something with the county to provide police services out in county areas, as one example of the kinds of things you guys could bring to the table.
It's a very good description of what is possible. So we would expect the local governments would get together, make a grant application for dollars. It could pay for the feasibility work. Will it really save money or not? And secondly, it could provide the dollars for the neutral third party that could work with all of those local governments together.
As another example, Mr. Chair, we're convening a group along with the Chief Operating Officer of folks who are involved in the assessment taxation program, the assessors and county commissioner from five Southwest counties to look at how we could find efficiencies in the assessment taxation program.
Okay. That's thanks.
Sure. Yeah. Another example, Mr. Chairman, would be two public works agencies who wanted to jointly build a facility and become more efficient. So any number of different ways you could do it.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions? This is only for a public hearing, and I thank you for this panel. That's all the people that signed up. Is there anyone else out there that wants to speak to Senate Bill 173? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 173. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 582. And I know there's going to be questions for you. Just thought I'd let you know that ahead of time. I know that our Senator Close has questions. So with that, we'll have a short explanation. And let's see. Do we have the list of who's coming up? So we're going to have Mark Long come on up first and bring whoever you want with you, Mark, and we'll let Raquel give a short explanation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 582 in its original form, there's a dash one amendment that has been passed out. We just received it, so we'll let Mark describe that one. But Senate Bill 582 in its original form directs the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs to adopt a rule that the department will charge the same fees and hourly rate for services that were charged by the county before assumption of services by the department. If the department assumes administration and enforcement of county manufactured dwelling services, a building inspection program, or part of a building inspection program when a county abandons or is unable to administer programs due to budget constraints resulting from reduced or eliminated federal timber payments. It also authorizes the department director to use departmental employees to administer and enforce the building program, or subject to certain requirements, hire building inspectors terminated by the county.
And with that, as we have tried to mention before, thanks to my Senator Przanski, this is fairly short notice with respect to the new amendment, so we're just going to have a hearing about it, and you're going to get to see them. They are pretty much a gut and stuff. I mean, if you really look at the bill, this is a total change of this bill, and I want people to understand that, so if you haven't got copies, you can get them and look for them, and if other people want to look. We are just having a public hearing, and there'll be time to have some more input on this one. But with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long, the Administrator of State Building Codes. I have with me Andrea Simmons from our office, who may be able to help on some of the technical questions that may come up. In anticipation of amendments just coming out, we provided a PowerPoint to provide an overview of what we are trying to do with this series of amendments, and I'd like to go through that with the Chair's permission right now. I don't know if we need to darken up the room or not, but just to give a little bit of background about the State Building Codes Division, we've been around for 40 years, where in 1973 you created a uniform set of standards that will apply to all municipalities across Oregon. Back in those days, it was thought that we needed to have a single place to resolve issues on building codes matter, make sure we were efficient, predictable as far as the construction environment, and really work towards consistency. We work with seven advisory boards that help us consult on codes, and just so everybody knows, on the issues that we're going to talk about here on kind of county support, all the fees and revenues we use are other fund, they're building permit fees, no general fund dollars are in my system at all. In Oregon, local administration is carried out using those state codes that we adopt through 130 different city and county building departments. They may assume those programs from the state. Where they choose not to run those programs, then the state is the default or the provider of last resort. Current law assumes that the programs kind of operate independently. The state operates its programs, and the counties and cities operate their programs. Again, the local building department fees are dedicated by Oregon statute for the use even in the local community related to building departments, and local building departments use state certified inspection staff. If you look at where we're at today, and the reason why we're bringing many of these amendments to you, the health of our cities and counties over the last 5 years has changed on the building department side. And you hear many things about the health of the counties, either because of general fund, timber payments. I'm really talking about the building permit revenue. And this chart here shows you that in a good year, we had about $75 million worth of building permit revenue paid to local government. This isn't state money. This is the local government side. That's just for the permits. Of course, then you would add plan reviews and system development charges and those kind of things on top. But it's dropped down significantly to around $48 million now. I think a more illustrative map is this of all the counties, and it includes the cities within the counties. We've got about 20 of the counties in the state of Oregon over the last 5 years that have seen a 40 to 80% decline in their building department revenue. And again, this is revenue paid to them by contractors or homeowners or whoever that are purchasing building permits for construction occurring in the local communities. We've had the one growth area, but that was because of a hospital in a small community. It can change the numbers in a small area, which it's great to have a hospital. It's in the Senator's district, but it did show growth, which might be an anomaly if you look at the map. When you look at the next map that I have, this shows the permit activity. And so when you compare the declining revenues and the shortfalls that folks have, and then that's declining activity. So when you get in many of our rural areas, whether it's in these areas or these areas or these areas, you have large areas to cover, declining revenues, and not a lot of activity. And that impacts your costs, and programs are looking at returning those back to the state or asking for help. And so the question is what do you do when you see those types of situations, and how can we be proactive in kind of making sure that we stabilize those local programs? So we started asking folks questions about a year ago when we had counties talking to us about surrendering their building permit program, their building inspection programs, running the state. So what did we need to do to help prop things up? Not in this bill, but I wanted to give the committee a flavor of all the things that we're doing to try to help rural Oregon. So we do have a bill on the House side that's going to help us create better and highly trained inspectors in the area and use a combination inspectors or multi-hatted so you can reduce travel distances, travel time on the government side. We're in this bill, and I'll talk about it, we've proposed smart codes for rural Oregon where we need to recognize the unique needs of remote structures that may not be in an urban setting, and how can we provide greater relief there. We absolutely need to make sure that our decisions between the fire code and the building code don't create delays, and we've clarified that in the proposed amendments. And we want to provide greater assistance to owner-builders who are trying to carry out work in these rural areas who may not have access to architects or engineers or other things, and ask our building inspectors to be a little bit more helpful, if you will, and provide maybe some typical drawings on simple structures so that folks can have certainty of what the regulatory requirements are and get through the process more efficiently, again, driving down the cost. We're asking for new tools for the state to respond to business and government needs. If there is a partnering agreement or programs come back, we need to be able to react quite quickly, because if we don't get up to speed at the state level, you could delay construction, delay projects, and then, of course, new tools to address the economic downturn in the local communities. So if you kind of look at the macro set of issues, kind of on the county assistance side related to building codes, there's House Bill 2206 it's a DAS bill. It's over on the House side, and it includes our organization, Revenue, Veterans, and Secretary of State, really looking at kind of the timber payment set range of issues, and we're part of that effort in the Rules Committee. We have House Bill 3144, which we've put those elements into the dash one of Senate Bill 582. That's over in, that's actually a typo, it's over in House Consumer Protection. And then Senate Bill 582, as the original bill is drafted, addresses programs that come back to the state and make sure that we have the ability to respond. So that's kind of the landscape out there. We attempted to put all those things into one place because we thought that might be more efficient. So this is what we've attempted to do with the amendments that you have before you. Again, we just got those 15 minutes before the hearing, so we are going through to make sure that they're technically accurate, and we'll work on any policy issues. But we wanted to make sure that we maintain the existing relationship between counties and state when they choose to run the programs independently. We're not changing any of that system. If, though, a county or a county and a city combination wants to work with the state to kind of avoid that sending the program back and get out in front of that issue, we've asked for new authority to create partnership agreements where we can look at regions of the area and get, if everybody agrees, we can come in and create a new service region, and maybe the state brings, as I've said to many folks, we bring technology and management experience, and other folks could use facility or vehicles and hiring. We can kind of combine resources and combine efforts to make the programs run a little bit more efficiently and less costly. And I think I've covered that. I'll move on. Allows us to respond to programs in kind of three different ways. If they're returned to us because the county or the jurisdiction decides just to give it up, they just don't want to do it anymore, here you go, comes back to the state, the flexibility tools that we put into the amendments would apply under that trigger. They would also apply if there was a request for a partnership agreement, again, that interesting or new area that we would put together, and then to support a significant project if those things were to come up, and we can talk about examples of when that happens. As part of this bill, there are new tools for us to assign resources from what we call a range of resources authorized by the legislature. Because I'm other fund and because I don't use general tax dollars, the thinking is we could have folks kind of vacant, nobody in them, but if we need to go to a partnering agreement, we would then use those employees, and of course the revenue that was coming in locally would support those positions. If we didn't have the revenue, we wouldn't hire the folks. We also picked up a provision that allows to hire the local government staff. If a program is coming back to us, we thought it made sense that if the employees there are already state certified and meet the qualifications and are in good standing, we ought to be able to hire those folks in an expedited manner, not go through significant delays to get them into the state system. So that provision's in there, and we actually got that idea from an element of 582 in its original content. Allows the state to use local government fees when we go in so that we're not establishing and adopting new fees. We would just be able to use the fees and the forms and the procedures that were there already. Right now, all my things are set in statute, and it would require a significant process in order to make that happen. So that gives us the flexibility to do that. And then we've took elements of House Bill 3326 that really established the kind of the smart codes concept, and we added them into this Dash 1 amendment. And they're actually the first four or five sections of the bill. My presentation's kind of backwards. I thought it might come out a little bit differently than what it did. But this is to establish clear policy direction that we need to have special consideration for structures that are built in rural Oregon. And this provides that, and you can see it right in the very beginning of the amendment, and allows us to create a flexible alternative building code when things are unsuitable for area. And we're really talking about remote structures or unique structures in local areas, and allows us to address some of the fire apparatus and means of approach, access, and those kinds of things that occur in rural Oregon. It clarifies the decisions of codes are for the construction side are made under the building official. There's been some confusion about that for 20-some years in the system, and we think that drives up costs, especially in rural Oregon, when people have to make callback trips or special arrangements. Allows government building officials and us to provide advice to building permit applicants without the fear of engaging in the practice of architecture and engineering. When you're really talking about rural structures, and the amendments in here really talk about wood frame structures, it's a technical term, group U in the building code, it's single-family dwellings, accessory to those buildings, pole barns, those kind of things. We think we can be more helpful, and we think we can provide kind of typical plans for owner-builders to use so that they have certainty of getting through the regulatory system without kind of getting into what I sometimes call a rock-fetching exercise with the regulator where they're not sure what to bring and folks go back and forth. And we think we can make the system work a little bit easier. And then there's a relief valve in the bill that the thinking is if we provide, it's not in these amendments, but if we provide the better training for this for the staff, we provide the better codes, the greater flexibility, the decision-making, the ability to do partnering agreements, if for some reason that still isn't going to be exercised at the local level, then there's a relief valve after adequate consultation for the customer to come to the state to maybe take advantage of some of those tools that we've put in. So I went kind of quick, but that gives you an overview of what we were trying to do with the Dash 1 amendments. It looks like they've covered all the elements in my first read of the bill of what I've talked about. I can't tell you if it's technically the way that we had asked, but we'll know that shortly. And, of course, we want to get feedback from folks. We've been working for over a year in both chambers and with stakeholders trying to address these issues and have the state be more proactive when it comes to rural issues. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
So with that, questions? Senator Close, do you have any questions?
Well, I just have a comment, Mr. Chair. This is a 20-page amendment. There's a lot of bold type. I would not be able to vote for this unless we went through this section by section and it really spelled out, because I have a lot of questions just in the first four pages.
Sure.
I understand what you're trying to do, but we're in a situation where we're worried about counties, you know, remaining solvent. But I want to make sure that, if the time comes that they are solvent, they can get their powers back. So I have to be assured of that.
Sure. I'll be happy to follow up with you through the chair. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, no, that's great. I would love to have
be happy to follow up and go through it again. It is a large bill and a large amendment, and we do. I don't want to suggest that it's ready for prime time, but we were glad that it got here in time for the committee so the folks that wanted to come testify can get it and we can work on it over the next several days.
Thank you.
I will tell you, from my perspective, I want to thank you for getting out there and being creative and looking at some stuff. It has been a consistent issue at different levels in building trades and how building gets going and whether the code is met or not met. My biggest issue is to make sure that the buildings we build are safe, they meet requirements that will stand up, that we have building inspectors that can actually check for the things that make it safe, electrical, wiring, when it comes to fire safety, all of those kinds of things. And I think we have good people in our counties, but when they run out of resources, when you have less than 500 permits and you're trying to hire, keep a person hired that has to go around all those areas, it's fairly difficult. And for me, I had a local contractor who built pole barns, and it was kind of, he got very frustrated with the Department of Justice because he'd have an engineering and he'd send it in, and eventually he'd get it approved, and he used to be able to have it approved, and then he could use that pole barn in multiple places as long as he could show the soil type was right. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it was kind of like, no, you got to redo this. And the idea of having certain buildings, which are structures in the rural areas, like pole barns and some others, where you could pick a general structure and not have to go through all the process, could be a really positive thing in our local area. So I'm happy that we're having the conversation. I hope that other people will look this over and come in with suggestions about how to make it the best it can possibly be, because I know that, and that's especially with respect to when people ask for help and you come in and help them, and then when they start getting back to the point where they're actually having a building going again, that it can back out, we want those things as well. So I just want to thank you for all the work that was done, because it's more than what the original bill was, and I think from my perspective in a positive way, and I think we'll find out if that's true as we have conversations with other people. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both. And with that, we have a group of people who would like to speak, and I know that some of them have just got these amendments, so they weren't sure exactly what was going on, but let me go with, I'm going to save some other ones, Mark Webb, King Williams, and Don Miner to begin with,
and then we'll have the backup people later.
Whoever wants to start.
I'll start.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of the bill. As pointed out, we just got the amendment, although a quick reading of it we think is very good. Mr. Long has a long history of thinking outside the box and moving the Oregon building codes forward. For those of you who may remember the e-permitting process that he led, the Department of Motor Vehicles computer system was still fresh in my mind when he did that. I think that, unlike that, his program came in ahead of schedule and under budget, and it's a model. What we see here is he wants to look down the road at the problems that are going to face our state and find solutions for them. I think on line 9, page 1 of the amendment, he's looking for an permission to experiment and to innovate and to look for cost-effective solutions. Wow, I mean, that's very impressive. I think it's on bottom of page 2, top of page 3. He's asking for permission for state code administrators and local government officials to help consumers and contractors through the building codes process to maybe even suggest alternatives, help them figure out the problems. And I guess we'd expect nothing less of public officials. And so with that, I'll conclude my remarks and just like to go on record and saying we support his proposal.
Thank you, Don. We'll go through the whole panel and we'll have any questions. Yes.
Mr. Chair, committee, it's nice to be before you again. I hope you don't mind if I'm before you again. But I've been familiar with some of what's going on here. I just got the new
dash. Oh, make sure your name.
Oh, Mark Webb, Grant County. And I want to support the bill as well, and my comments are pretty brief. I think this is an attempt to really meet the intent that the building codes were developed for and the desired outcomes for which they were established in a way that is both responsible and novel. It's very sensitive to the changing conditions we have now, as opposed to a compilation over time. When each of these things individually are added, they make sense, but collectively taken together, they're pretty hard to apply lots of times. So my sense is that they're not trying to get away from any of the appropriate desired outcomes and goals. They're trying to do things differently that will work on site in a much more effective way. In reading through the bill, it does involve partnerships in a way that have never happened in the past. And frankly, unless you have state-county partnerships like this is proposing, you're going to continue to have roadblocks, you're going to continue to have more expensive building, and you're going to compromise, at least in rural areas, rural efforts to become somewhat self-sustaining and take ownership for what they want to do. It adds flexibility to the building codes. Again, it doesn't relieve building codes of any of their main responsibilities in terms of safety, risk, and those sorts of things, but it gives them greater flexibility for meeting those sorts of objectives. And finally, at least in rural areas, the timeliness of this, it really can expedite a lot of what's going on. Our building seasons are shorter. It's hard to get crews in our areas. We just don't have the same amount of work. The more you can expedite a process, the less it's going to cost the business to invest, the quicker they're going to have a return on that investment, and the quicker they're going to have people employed and making money. So I would just end with that.
My name is King Williams, and I'm a resident of Grant County. I'm a consultant there, and I've lived there all my life. I've worked with landowners and people building from a veteran on that lived way out in the North Fork of the John Day River, trying to build a place for him to retire, having trouble with getting the right permits and et cetera, and meeting all the codes too. My latest, I've been working with the Sylvie's Valley Ranch and Scott Campbell in his endeavor to bring economic development into Grant County and Harney County. So that's where my experience has come from, is from both ends of the spectrum. And I'm here supporting the efforts of Mark Long and the Building Codes Division in this amended bill in order to alleviate the problems that we've seen exist in the process. Those problems come in term all the way as it's laid out in here, from the permit applications, the plan reviews, the specialty code requirements, the duality of for instance the fire marshal or the building codes. Who is it that we have to meet those codes, meet the requirements of? The energy efficiency codes, they may be good in Salem or Portland or large metropolitan areas, but when you have some of the things that we've run up against out in rural Oregon in the buildings that, some of the buildings, not all of them, but some of them, for instance, a slab, when you build an ag building and then the code allows and the planning allows for us to change the use of that building from ag to a combined use of when we brought interns to the Sylvie's Valley Ranch and wanted to build living quarters for the interns in part of a building. We didn't have insulation under the slabs or around the foundations of those buildings. You know, there was a lot of mitigating building that was done to make them more efficient, and those buildings were added in with higher levels of heat pumps and insulation in the ceilings, et cetera, and the walls. So the point of the slab insulation was to make sure that we more efficiently utilized the energy that was to heat those. Well, the building code currently is pretty hard and fast on that. The flexibility needs to be given to the Building Codes Division in order to either waive or look at mitigating factors. There's other things like put the size of a building that you have to put sprinkler systems in. You know, those sprinkler systems in Sylvie's Valley number one, are going to freeze because when it gets 40 below zero, it's really hard to keep a sprinkler system from freezing. Plus, if that building were to go on fire, you would have to bring in a, in order for to make them work appropriately, you have to bring a fire truck in to charge that system. And by the time that's happened, you've got a pile of ashes anyway, and there's nothing around it. The reason for sprinkler systems a lot of times is to protect the buildings around it from going up as well. If you mitigate that by making sure that there's proper egress, proper safety factors as far as fire alarms or other things that would take the place of, you know, the human protection, the human safety, as opposed to trying to protect the building. It's up the landowner, the person's building it. It's his responsibility for the safety of the building. You know, he's not, I mean, for the whether or not it burns down, because most of those rural areas, if it starts a fire on our ranch, you know, when the barn started to fire, we didn't rely upon anybody. We made sure that the livestock was gone and it burned down to the ground, and we built a new one. It wouldn't have mattered if we would have had a sprinkler system. It wasn't going to work. So this kind of a code change is going to be, would give the flexibility and allow alternatives to be used by the developers in these areas. It wouldn't, the waivers would have to be given on a case-by-case basis and looking at the rationale for them. The other thing would be that the idea of allowing the inspectors or the plan reviewers to offer some kind of back and forth on design. You know, there's a lot of these buildings are, as these, you know, gentlemen have talked about, and like Mark said, you know, there's some pretty standard buildings that are being used design. And when you build one building and you're building four more somewhere else, that building inspector or the plan reviewer could look at it and offer some advice, offer some options without taking the time. The problem we have, the problem that's coming in rural Oregon, is that when it takes a lot of time and pushes back the project to the point that we may lose an entire season of building when we're trying to stay on schedule, and that whole season of building would, you know, cost money. And in fact, if it's some developer that's having to borrow money, it may kill the project just because we can't come to terms with the inspectors. And especially, we've come across the fact where you've got an ordinality of applications you have to make, where you have to, you start with planning, DEQ, structural permits, plumbing permits, electrical permits. We won't let you get one permit until you've got the next permit. There needs to be some bringing all those together to allow for not only just like one inspector but to allow for an application to be made for a project and looked at in its totality, as opposed to, well, bring us the structural and we'll look at that plan, and then bring us the electrical and we'll look at that plan. We'll bring you the whole set of plans and have it reviewed and approved. The timeliness of inspections has been talked about, and that's very important for when we're building, when we have such a short season out in rural Oregon, and when you're trying to get things done before fall, closed in, and we're waiting on, we have to have the structural inspector out there before we can have the electrical inspector out there, before we can have the plumbing inspector, before we can close it in. We need some help in that realm of bringing maybe multiple faceted inspectors in, or having the ability to in some places allow them to take pictures once you get comfortable with through building codes. I think Mark Long has been great to work with, and his innovative approaches bear a lot of weight, and I think that we should look at this bill, and we support it. The way it's written, I think, is very appropriate.
Any questions for this panel?
No. Okay. Thank you.
Next, we have Nathan Phillips and Brian Craig. And again, thank you, and thanks for the short notice. We know this just came, so it's hard to look at it. So any things you make today, we certainly look forward to any other comments people have to make later.
Thank you, Senator Roland. My name is Nathan Phillips. I'm an electrical contractor from Eugene. I also have a real estate development company, so I work both as an owner, developer, and as a contractor, so I kind of understand both sides of this. Just in case anybody's cares about this, I know it's in Senator Brzezinski's district. The Ducks are up by 14 with about 3 minutes left in the game.
Thank you so. Very much.
Thank you. We are appreciative. We've been wondering about that, actually, so thank you.
I saw they had the lead at half and just saying, hope they play another 20 minutes all the way.
So I'm here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association as well as myself. We at NECA have been working with building codes for the last year or so on the concepts in this bill to improve building regulations in rural Oregon and give the building codes division more flexibility in the application of building codes. As Mark Long said, we fund these programs through our permit fees, and so it's important to us that they be efficiently run. And this Senate Bill 582-1 amendments appear to be the product of this work and adequately or accurately represent what we've been trying to accomplish. The things that we see in this bill that are important to us are flexibility for particularly in rural Oregon and in general for the state, flexibility in terms of how building codes are applied, consistency in particular in the application of fire codes. We have issues all the time with conflicts between the building code and the fire code, and this makes clear how those issues get resolved. It creates adaptability for the building codes. We often have situations in specialty structures, particularly in rural Oregon, as you've been hearing about, where the code doesn't provide the level of adaptability that we need to address our needs, both as our customers' needs when we're contractors and as developers. On large public projects, this gives the building codes division the ability to create a better coordination between various public agencies, and maybe most importantly, it gives the state the flexibility to respond to the changing construction environment. As you saw in Mark Long's slides, the permit revenue has really declined, not surprisingly, over the last 5 years. And as that building starts to slope back up, the state needs to be able to ramp up and hire the appropriate number of employees to meet that need. So I won't belabor that anymore and appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg. Today I'm representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. I would echo everything that Mr. Phillips has said. This is, as we know with the Dash 1, we are merging several things into here, but it's a nice package that really does dovetail together. And I'd really like to say this is a bill that is a jobs bill for rural Oregon. It really has that kind of an impact on it. It's going to make it easier for our contractors to work with their clients out there. It's going to make it easier and better for the local governments to be able to do things with the State Building Codes Department also. I'm going to dial down into the parts from House Bill 3144 in particular, and that is the issue of what happens realistically if a local government needs to turn back a program to the state. This is something that we discovered back in 2011, and we dodged a big bullet. Coos County almost gave the program back to the state. And in looking at that, we had a lot of rules for how the state gave the programs out. We didn't really have a pathway back. And it was cumbersome, it was messy, and it would be slow. And actually what it would really realistically have done, because of some of the requirements we have about hiring and hiring freezes and things like that with the state, it would take a couple of months for the state to have picked up the program. Okay, for my construction industry folks and their clients out there and everything, can you imagine just stopping for a couple of months to wait to go through this kind of a process, even a couple of weeks? Anybody who's done a house remodel has probably yanked their hair out of, you know, for some kind of a small delay. So it's really important from our contractor's standpoint that we know that we have the assurance that there's a pathway that this can be picked up. And I think that many of those things that were talked about by Mr. Long in his slides about being able to instantly bring on board a local building official who has got the certification to just make them part of the team, that's the smart kind of stuff out there. And the other issue is the pathway we have right now with the local governments is, if you got to give it up, it's really black and white. You have to give it up. There's really no in-between where the state could kind of work with you to, you know, pick you up off the carpet and dust you off and get you back in the fight. And I think that's one of the things, Senator Close, that you were really, you know, looking at, is the fact is we don't, you know, they don't want to necessarily give it away for forever if it's a short-term situation. But then again, we may want to be able to have some differing types of things where it's a little bit more of a hybrid than what we used to have in the past. So basically, we're adapting to the future, and that's what we need from you in this bill. And my clients really need the assurance that that this would give. It gives flexibility, efficiency, and there's also a couple of things in the bill, some language in there that's transparency-oriented, in that if Mr. Long, as the director of the department, makes certain of these changes, he does have to bounce them off of the affected construction boards that are out there. And also, if he does that, he's got to bring back a report to you at the end of the year on that. And I think that that's important. That will conclude my testimony.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Yes. In Section 14, you talk about, or the amendment talks about, if they want to come back, it's a two-year period. They may resume the administration enforcement of the Havana program only on July 1st of an odd-numbered year. Can you explain to me how that would work? Suppose you just made the decision in December.
We can have
December
Long
31st.
Come up to if you want, if you think that's Mark.
Chair Roblin, it would be probably good for Mark Long to come up. I would like to note, Senator, that is existing language that's been there for a long time, and we put that in quite a long time ago because we did have a scenario where we had, at that time, some local jurisdictions that were kind of going into a program and then trying to back out after a large project occurred in their district, and there was a lot of discussions. This was about 10, 12 years ago, and that there, you know, so there is a little bit of a rationale of we need to have a little time to make sure that we're going back into the program and doing it in a logical manner.
I understand, Fulton.
Sure.
I'm just wondering what the maximum time would be there. You're going from July 1 of an odd-numbered year. So what would be the maximum it could take if you went out in an even numbered year and it hadn't been 2 years? Would it be
2 years?
Well,
would it always be 2 years?
For the record, Mark Long with Building Codes. With the Senator, through the Chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and Senator Close, that is existing law. I think we worked on those issues back in 2001, if I remember correctly. And the way the system works now is jurisdictions every 4 years kind of re-request to run the programs, and it's a four-year cycle. If they abandon that program within that four-year cycle, the fastest they could get it back is 2 years later, and it could, depending on the timing within that four-year cycle, be up to the 4 years, you know, right around, just depends on the timing. So it's between 2 and 4 years under the existing statutory structure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Thomas?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I heard this right, we have the state building department likes it, the contractors like it, and it has a possibility of creating more jobs. I like it.
In rural areas.
In rural area.
What's the name of the committee?
Yeah.
What's the name of the committee? What can I say?
Okay.
No further questions? I thank you very much for your time today. And so we will close our public hearing. And is there anybody else? That's everybody on our list. Anybody else that wanted to talk about 582? 582, right. If not, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 582. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 719. We have an amendment, and I think we're going to just put it in. That way they can get the fiscal done. And so, and we have one person here. We'll have them come on up and explain a little bit. Just so people know, on 719, we had a fiscal that came out that showed, a revenue that came out and said that this bill was going to raise a little bit more money than we anticipated with the numbers we're putting into it in our amendments. And so we have here, I've invited up a member of the sheep industry who can explain a little bit about what happened and why we think that might be a little different. So we don't have all the paperwork, but we do like the amendments. I think they're the right ones, and we can put those in today, and then we can make sure that we get that further. And we'll carry this over until Monday, or Tuesday. So with that, a short explanation of what was going on so that maybe people can understand a little more about that.
Yeah, hi, I'm Reed Anderson, sheep producer from Brownsville, Oregon, and also I'm on the American Land Board, which it's always a challenge for us to try to get any statistics that are clear from trying to get a handle on how many sheep there actually are and how many sheep are marketed, and just on any price reporting is very difficult for us to try to get a handle on just price reporting across the nation. Anyways, brought to my attention that the Department of Agriculture Revenue Department, they had some statistics there that weren't indicative, or they weren't even close to what we have in a marketing year with the state of Oregon. So we went to the USDA statistics and we come up with their figure, which was really close to what we had already anticipated with the amount of sheep and lambs that are actually marketed in a year in 2012, 2013, which I think was about 60 or 70,000 head a year in the state of Oregon, which is pretty much what we had figured. I don't know what, I don't really understand what transpired to come up with those original figures.
So we didn't get a copy of that here. So what was the original number, did you think, that they thought they you would raise?
I'm not real sure, but I think it was a neighborhood of 200,000.
A little different.
And how much do you usually need to run the organization?
Well, I think, we've had declining revenues for several years, but I think we really need between $25,000 and $30,000.
Mr. Chair, yes. I think we found some revenue.
Yeah, exactly. No kidding.
The revenue chair is over there with her calculator.
Taking notes. Yeah.
So we were a little shocked when we saw the number, and instead of being excited in the positive way from the Sheep Commission, they were saying, we don't want that kind of money from our people. So, yeah. And we put some new numbers. The amendments basically show, I think it's 10 cents for the minimum, and then up to a total of 50 cents. Or dollar. I'll let.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the -1 amendment sets the minimum assessment at 50 cents per head,
okay,
and then it prohibits the commission from increasing the assessment by more than 10 cents in any 12-month period. Mm-hmm. And the maximum, which was already in the bill, was $1 per head.
That's right. So we think that should raise about $25,000.
A new meaning of sweeping an agency.
Yeah, that's right. No kidding. And so we're hopeful we'll get that back in the next day or so, and then we will put this on for a work session. So we're just going to carry this one over until Tuesday. I did talk to Senator Whitsitt, who will carry the bill. So, but I don't think he would have carried it if it was $200,000. That would have been fun. So thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
And understanding that the USDA does do a list of how much meat was sold and how many lambs were sold in the state, and that's a good place to figure out an estimate. And we're hopeful that, as and you've talked to the people in revenue, and we hopeful we'll get a decision back on that pretty soon.
Perfect.
So, yes.
Just one comment. Leaving the maximum, and we are leaving the maximum of $1 per head in there?
I think we, yes, we are. And we're going to start it out at 50, 10 cents a year is the most they can move it, and 50 is what they're going to start it at. 50
in 10
cents.
Years, though, they could go up that
to the dollar, and they'd be done. Wouldn't be any higher.
A little uncomfortable with that maximum, but okay.
We took them for, we asked the commission themselves, so that's where the numbers came from. So with that, I would entertain a motion for the amendment so that we can actually get it in the bill and then.
Yes, let's see, where are we at here? Senator Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-18-2013.
Senator Bertscher moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments dated 3-18-13 to Senate Bill 719. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. And with that, we'll close our work session on Senate Bill 719. And is there anything else that needs to come before anybody have any questions or thoughts? I see none. So we're going to close our Senate Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee. Have a great day.